Every piece of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand in the rain and say, shit, it's raining!
I did what I did for the good of the realm. The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left once we abandon the lie? Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail.
Hello, boys and girls. It's Monday, and here is Terrible Tommy back at the microphone right here in the bunker deep in the ground in northwestern North Central Indiana. Forgot what part of the state I was in for a minute there. I was in La La Land. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and that's where you send all your moolah so we can keep operating here and, well... We got a small budget, but I'll tell you, it helps to get the goodies in here so we can help some other people out. So anyhow, and go to resist.com because we're rebuilding it. The webmaster, the She-Wolf webmaster is rebuilding the website. It's going to be better than ever. We're eliminating a few things, but... I got to confess to you, I'm eliminating a lot of the Hollywood Nazi stuff because we don't need it anymore. We are white racial separatists. That's what we should be. As far as I'm concerned, our symbol should be the non-equal sign. Yeah, I'm putting that all over the country. And you don't even need to buy stickers if you don't want to. You can take a felt pen with you wherever you go, and it's a very simple thing to put up the non-equal sign, you know. Yeah, so let's get it on. Let's get on to the show here. You remember Bill Clinton's genocide in Kosovo and Serbia? Remember that when we were bombing the hell out of Eastern Europe? Let's hear a little bit more about what happened after that, and the involvement of the American government. So-called American government.
Kosovo chaos undercuts Clinton's success. President Bill Clinton's Kosovo War of 1999 was loved by neocons and liberal hawks, the forerunner for Iraq, Libya, Syria, and other conflicts this century, but Kosovo's political violence and lawlessness today underscore the grim consequences of those strategies even when they succeed, writes Jonathan Marshall. The insatiable appetite of America's bipartisan foreign policy elites for military intervention despite its record of creating failing states in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen traces back to the marriage of liberal and neoconservative interventionists during the Clinton administration's 78-day bombing of Serbia to create the breakaway state of Kosovo in 1999. One scholar advocate has called NATO's campaign the most important precedent supporting the legitimacy of unilateral humanitarian intervention. Even Senator Bernie Sanders was proud to support that use of American power, ostensibly to prevent further genocide. Kosovo Foreign Minister Hashim Thaçi. Kosovo Foreign Minister, and former leader of the Kosovo Liberation Army, Hashim Thaçi. But Kosovo, which is still not recognized as an independent state by nearly half of all UN members, and which still relies on 4,600 NATO troops to maintain order, is hardly a showcase for the benefits of military intervention. With an unemployment rate of 35%, Kosovo is racked by persistent outbreaks of terrorism, crime, and political violence. Following a series of violent street protests and wild disruptions of parliament, the leader of the Radical Nationalist Party, Veta Vendisj, announced on February 19, "This regime is now in its final days. They will not last long." That day, members of Veta Vendisj set off tear gas canisters in parliament and tussled with police in the latest of their many protests against an agreement reached by the government last summer to grant limited powers to the country's Serbian minority, in return for Serbia's recognition of Kosovo. Opposition lawmakers also rail against endemic corruption and the country's underperforming economy. 2 days earlier, at least 15,000 Kosovars gathered in the central square of Pristina, the country's capital, to demand the government's resignation. In January, thousands of protesters clashed with police, hurling Molotov cocktails, setting a major government building and armored police cars on fire, and wounding 24 police officers. The aim of this protest was to overthrow the government with violence, the government said in a statement. The United States ambassador chimed in, "Political violence threatens democracy and all that Kosovo has achieved since independence. This violence gets little attention from the American media in part because, unlike the Ukrainian demonstrators who overthrew their democratically elected government in 2014, Kosovo's protesters are targeting a pro-Western government that eagerly seeks membership in the European Union. But it's no wonder that Kosovo's political fabric is so rent by violent confrontations. The rump state was created by a violent secessionist movement led by the Kosovo Liberation Army, KLA. That guerrilla band of Albanian nationalists was covertly backed by the German Secret Service to weaken Serbia. Its terrorist attacks on Serbian villages and government personnel in the mid-1990s prompted a brutal military crackdown by Serbia, followed by NATO's decisive intervention in 1999. During the fighting, the KLA drove tens of thousands of ethnic Serbs from Kosovo as part of an ethnic cleansing campaign to promote independence for the majority Albanian population. It recruited Islamist militants including followers of Osama bin Laden from Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Afghanistan, and other countries. President Bill Clinton's special envoy to the Balkans, Robert Gelbard, called the KLA without any question, a terrorist group, and a Council on Foreign Relations backgrounder added, most of its activities were funded by drug running. None of that, however, stopped Washington from embracing the KLA's cause against Serbia, a policy spearheaded by the liberal interventionist First Lady Hillary Clinton and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Without authorization from the United Nations, NATO began bombing Serbia in March 1999, killing some 500 civilians, demolishing billions of dollars worth of industrial plants, bridges, schools, libraries, and hospitals, and even hitting the Chinese embassy. It should be lights out in Belgrade, demanded New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. Every power grid, water pipe, bridge, road, and war-related factory has to be targeted. Like it or not, we are at war with the Serbian nation. Following Serbia's capitulation, according to Human Rights Watch, elements of the KLA engaged in widespread and systematic burning and looting of homes belonging to Serbs, Roma, and other minorities and the destruction of Orthodox churches and monasteries. This destruction was combined with harassment and intimidation designed to force people from their homes and communities. By late 2000, more than 210,000 Serbs had fled the province. The desire for revenge provides a partial explanation, but there is also a clear political goal in many of these attacks, the removal from Kosovo of non-ethnic Albanians in order to better justify an independent state. Former KLA leaders, including its political head Hashim Thaçi, went on to dominate the new Kosovo state. A 2010 report by the Council of Europe declared that Thaçi, who was then Kosovo's prime minister, headed a mafia-like group that smuggled drugs, guns, and human organs on a grand scale through Eastern Europe. The report's author accused the international community of turning a blind eye while Thaçi's group of KLA former KLA leaders, including its political head Hashim Thaçi, went on to dominate the new Kosovo state. A 2010 report by the Council of Europe declared that Thaçi, who was then Kosovo's prime minister, headed a mafia-like group that smuggled drugs, guns, and human organs on a grand scale through Eastern Europe. The report's author accused the international community of turning a blind eye while Thaçi's group of KLA veterans engaged in assassinations, detentions, beatings, and interrogations to maintain power and profit from their criminal activities. Prime Minister Thaçi and the Kosovo government strenuously denied the allegations and succeeded for years in resisting accountability. Their American friends were eager to put the past behind as well. In 2012, Madeleine Albright and a former Clinton special envoy to the Balkans bid to take control of the country's state-owned telecommunications company despite widespread allegations of corruption, the attempted assassination of the telecommunications regulatory chief, and the murder of the state privatization agency's chief. No one seemed immune from corruption. A study of the European Union's own legal mission to Kosovo suggested that its members may have taken bribes to drop investigations of senior Kosovo politicians for rampant criminal activity. In 2014, a three-year EU investigation concluded that senior officials of the former Kosovo Liberation Army should be indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including unlawful killings, abductions, enforced disappearances, illegal detentions in camps in Kosovo and Albania, sexual violence, other forms of inhumane treatment, forced displacements of individuals from their homes and communities, and desecration and destruction of churches and other religious sites. Under tough pressure from the United States and EU, Kosovo's parliament finally agreed last summer to permit a special court to prosecute former KLA leaders for war crimes. The court will begin operating this year in The Hague. The sad thing is that the United States and European countries knew 10 years ago that Thaçi and his men were engaged in drug smuggling and creating a mafia state, said one European ambassador last year. The attitude was, "He's a bastard, but he's our bastard." Whether delayed justice will clean up Kosovo's mafia state, and whether belated granting of rights to the Serbian minority will ease or aggravate Kosovo's explosive ethnic tensions, remain to be seen. One thing's for sure, a great many people have died in the name of this great humanitarian intervention, and many more are still suffering for it. Kosovo is no Libya or Syria, but neither is it any kind of showcase for the benefits of the United States armed intervention. Jonathan Marshall is author or co-author of 5 books on international affairs.
This is why the conservative struggles, conservative movement is just as criminal as the progressive movement, because these are the people that were spurring on all this intervention, bombing the hell out of Serbia. And if you'll check back in my radio shows at that time, I supported the Serbians 100%, and because I knew what was going on. Now, the question is Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, are they Manchurian candidates? I begin to think half of the government is Manchurian candidate. That's why we should have nothing to do with them. We shouldn't support any of their people who are running for office. We shouldn't vote for them. These are all criminals and enemies of our position, white racial separation. And beyond that, they're the enemies of most others. Remember Bill Clinton and his trade programs that virtually destroyed the Mexican agriculture, and he destroyed thousands and thousands of jobs here in the United States. I think a case could be made that they're all Manchurian candidates. If so, they need to be arrested, tried, and executed. I'm not leaving the Republicans off the hook because the neocons are up to their neck in all of this stuff, even more than the Democrats. How about this vote in South Carolina? What, 700,000 people voted? That's interesting. It's interesting that the Christ Insanity candidate, Cruz, lost out. Now, what that means is people voted with their pocketbook. Yeah, follow the money. A lot of military presence in South Carolina, and a lot of capitalistas. And so it looks like they voted for Trump following the money. So get that straight. They voted for the money over their religion, all those evangelicals. That gives you an idea how thin their so-called religion is. And another question. If 700,000 people voted, how many blacks voted? There had to have been a reasonable number of blacks voted for Trump. And if so, that must scare the bejesus out of the system. If Trump wins and he gets to run in the final election, are a whole lot of blacks going to come across the line and vote for Trump? I think they may be surprised. Here's a note from Stray Dog back there in New Germany. Thank you, TT, so much for letting your robot assistant read Dylan Storm's Roof's comments on race relations. Roof sounds like he is many years older than his age. Anyone know how to send support to Dylan Roof? I think he should be supported. Well, let's find out. Let's dig around and see if we can get an address for him. I was very impressed with what he said. I was very impressed. I've got something here about a coup that put Reagan and Bush in power. Yeah. Now, remember, Reagan, before he got in there, I don't know whether he was thinking for himself or not, but once he got in there, he was relying on an astrologist on every move he made. Of course, Reagan was an unindicted war criminal with the people who were killed in Central America and Nicaragua because of their intervention and claiming, we got to stop the communists. Yeah, well, I was, that's why I quit supporting Ronald Reagan way back, and when I was leading the Klan and told the Klan, don't support this guy. But the Klan all over the country ran out and supported him. That's why we can't deal with the right wing, even the right wing racial people. We can't deal with them if they don't understand what's going on, or they're too stupid to figure it out. Or maybe they're Manchurian candidates too. But we have to delineate between us and even right-wing racialist whites, because they've got most of the program wrong. And based upon what they've got wrong, they don't do right. So remember, war is not good for our race. And the right-wing and even right-wing racialists support wars. And remember, the War of 1848 in Europe freed up a whole lot of people, were scared the shit out of them, and they left Europe and came over to the United States, and that's what filled up a big share of people in the Union Army in the Civil War. Without that infusion of all that European blood into the Union forces, Lincoln probably would have thought very firmly about, well, maybe I hadn't ought to get into this damn thing with the South. And if that had happened, there didn't have to be a war, Confederate war. It didn't have to be a civil war. And, of course, there we lost, what, 500,000-600,000 men? But you don't even count the civilian women and children and property damage. Remember what happened there. They developed all these new weapons in the Confederacy and in the Union. Even came up with a rocket, and the Confederates fired a rocket at one point in the war. They came up with aerial photography and aerial bombardment, even from balloons and so forth and so on, machine guns, Gatling gun, and so forth. And guess what that did? That went right on up and got into the First World War. Now, everybody complains about Hitler. Well, the war in Europe was almost over when Wilson decided to jump in and take all of white American troops, mostly, into the First World War. Well, if the war would have stopped and the United States hadn't entered the war, Germany wouldn't have been weakened so badly that there wouldn't have been a Weimar Republic, and their money wouldn't have been inflated out of existence, which led directly into the bad times that put Hitler in power. So there's linkage in all this. So there's a domino effect. But we had to go over there, and our government, and jump in. Wilson. There was no need at all for Wilson to enter World War One. So you can go all the way back, if you're going to condemn what happened in World War Two in Germany and so forth, you got to go all the way back to people like Wilson, that while talking peace and talking no war, he lied through his teeth to the American people, and the minute he got into office, he got us into the war. And like I said before, that led directly into World War II. And I've said before 100 times, if you didn't like Hitler, you shouldn't have had World War I. Or at least the United States shouldn't have intervened, which strengthened the powers to fight on and on until they were exhausted, which led to wide-scale famine and so forth, and destruction of industry and everything, to where obviously a strong man had to appear. Whenever these neocons are promoting going to war any place in the world, you better think about it twice, and don't volunteer to go. Don't go. And if they try to draft you, flee the country. Yeah, because you're going to be on the wrong side of your race. Now, this is where I get off the boat. Well, it's one of the ways I get off the boat with the right-wing racialist, because they're still hanging on to the goddamn right-wing reactionaries. Jack London, he only made one mistake. He came out and supported World War One while the rest of the socialists opposed it. He made a mistake there. He shouldn't have done that. Otherwise, Jack London was a great, good man. But back then, your socialists were the people trying to keep us out of war. So all this bullshit about, oh, the socialists are horrible, you better start reading your history. You better start rereading history. Because if they weren't for the capitalists and making huge amounts of money making arms and guns and all that kind of stuff, you know? Anyhow, we didn't win World War II. We didn't win World War I, because we always have to see through racial eyes, through white racial eyes. On any controversy, you have to come down on the side of what is good for the white race and what's bad. And what's good for the Republican conservatives, in most cases, is bad for us. And the same way with the liberal left. In many cases, in most cases, when they oppose war, that's good. When they oppose the big banks, that's good. When they oppose the destruction of the environment, I have no problem with the progressives. But when they go along with warfare, where more and more whites get killed, when they go along with allowing everybody and his brother, especially non-whites, to come into this country, then they're no good. So anyhow, that's my position, and I hope you stick with it. I'm going to send you a lecture about how Ronald Reagan, that son of a bitch, got us into some real problems in the Middle East, and how he won the election and defeated Carter. I wasn't a great big fan of Carter, but Carter was anti-war, and which was a good thing. Ronald Reagan was put into the White House with a crime via back channels, elements of the Bush crime organization. He promised Iran weapons if it promised to keep the U.S. embassy hostages in captivity until Reagan was elected in office. Just like clockwork, the very moment Jimmy Carter was leaving the White House, the hostages were released. Mission accomplished for the bad guys. Now, remember how many guys he got killed in a... We lost some men in that attempted rescue, which Carter was evidently pushed into that. And remember, we were supplying Iraq with all kinds of poison gas and everything else, weapons to both sides, selling them, you know, throughout the whole thing. So our fingers of the United States corrupt government was involved in all of it. And it just keeps going. It never ends. Looks like the Christian solidarity is sort of fractured. In South Carolina especially, we see this. I'm going to run you this article here and see what you think.
The continued popularity of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz among many...
The continued popularity of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz among many conservative Christian voters demands an explanation, especially for those who shudder at the very idea that one of these two men might get within sniffing distance of the White House. I propose that Trump and Cruz represent two very different kinds of failures for conservative Christianity, one old and long-standing, the other new and more disturbing. Ted Cruz is the easier case. For the most part, he is following a particularly hard-line version of the old Christian right script, now operative in its 10th presidential election. You know it, abortion bad, gay marriage really bad, liberals bad, secularism bad, Democrats bad. And, godly America, historic Christian heritage, call America back to God, take America back from the liberals, get the right judges on the Supreme Court, etc. It's a familiar script, and it has been taught in many of America's most conservative churches for decades. It is a message certainly not confined to Ted Cruz. Many of us on the progressive evangelical side have been protesting this version of Christian public witness for a long time. It fails in ways we have specified, including its exceedingly narrow version of Christian moral concern and oversimplified reading of Christian history. Still, those conservative Christians who support Ted Cruz based on that script are in many cases following the explicit teaching of their churches. They are good disciples in the terms that have been presented to them and that they believe. Their pastors have reason to be pleased with them. Donald Trump is doing something very different and much more frightening. In his demeanor, he is violating every prior accepted standard of presidential civility. He is lathering up audiences for systematic demeaning of specific targeted groups, notably Muslims and Hispanics, through security appeals over terrorists and undocumented immigrants. He has also dismissed moral concerns about torture and other rule of law considerations in war and foreign policy. He has more than once expressed respect for the leadership and toughness of foreign dictators. In sum, here is a presidential candidate frequently characterized by xenophobia, cruelty, vulgarity, and authoritarianism. So then the question arises again, how exactly can self-identified followers of Jesus support this man? Based on my long and extensive experience with evangelicals, I cannot believe that any sizable number of these Christians have been taught to look for such characteristics in a president. So their supporting Trump does not respond to prior church teaching in the way that supporting Cruz responds to prior teaching. I find it very hard to imagine that too many pastors have offered this delightful Trumpian menu as part of their Christian instruction. There are two main ways to interpret what is going on here. One lays most of the blame at the feet of these self-identified Christians. That is, in supporting this kind of person for president, they are denying the teaching they have received. They are being disobedient, or at best, nominal Christians. The other interpretation, though, is even more disturbing. That would be the idea that in the Christian moral formation of these supposed Christians, they have not been offered an adequate inoculation against this kind of politics. What they needed was instruction in a version of Christianity with ironclad commitments to civility, solidarity, justice, mercy, compassion, rule of law, and human rights, commitments so strong and so well ingrained in believers that to support someone like Trump would be unthinkable. But they have not received that inoculation. So it is not there now, when it is needed, when the body politic faces a mesmerizing candidate of this exact type. So I am saying that many conservative Christians support Ted Cruz because they embrace a flawed but familiar 40-year Christian right political project, now being advanced by its most aggressive, clever, and well-funded candidate. Or they support Donald Trump because of a failure of their Christian moral formation to inoculate them against aspects of his person and message that should disqualify him. It's a failure either way. But the latter failure is more radical, and more dangerous.
I love it when these people who've been used to brainwashing people since little kids and have a mind control center on every corner begin to slip and begin to lose. Well, Trump is simply appealing to the human animal, not to the human spook. And it works every time. I mean, you know, look at all these countries that have had these wars, and you look at how all the Germans, whether right or wrong, solidified in World War II, almost all of them. Do you think there were many of them listening to the church? I don't think so. A lot of the good share of the SS men were Catholics. Didn't seem to stop them from doing humanistic animal things. No, Christ's insanity is just a method of the ruling class to keep the bulk of the people in tow and under control. And I don't care. Karl Marx might have said that, but it's true. It's true. Lenin might have said it, but it's true. Problem with those two is that they wanted to replace it with their own kind of church, the Church of Karl Marx, and control them that way. So, you know, it's pretty hard for people to get out from under being controlled, but it's easy to understand because they allow themselves to be controlled. You wonder why you got bad politicians and leaders, bad cops and all this kind of stuff. Because the general public is bad. The general population is not so good, not to put it lightly. They stand around, I can't understand why we have such bad leaders. Well, where do the leaders come from, jerk? They come from the public, and the public is jaded and corrupt. Only smaller minorities of them are not. If Trump got a pretty large Negro vote in South Carolina, that's going to blow all their theories out of the water. I can't wait to see how that turned out. Oh, the Quakers in 1789 formed the first lobby to try to get rid of slavery. The trouble is, there were a lot of people against slavery, but they weren't against Negroes. They didn't want to get rid of them altogether and send them back. That's the problem. I could go along with them getting rid of slavery. What a wasteful and retarded technology by decades and maybe 100 years because of depending on slave labor instead of ingenuity of the white man to develop and technocracy and so forth. Well, anybody that tells you it was wonderful to get rid of slavery but then does not tell you it would have been wonderful to get rid of the Negroes, out of the country, he's just as bad as the rest. In fact, he's worse because he's only got a half right. Then they turned all the Negroes loose on the roads and streets of America. Wow, man. I wonder about whether the white race is as superior as we think we are. Anyhow, it was primarily the Quakers that were advancing this anti-slavery thing, and it almost caused the split up of the country hardly before the ink was dry on the Constitution. Don't forget, later on, New York City and New York State were talking about seceding. So there were northern states were talking about secession even before it got real popular in the South. And you know how they softened up the militia people up there in the Northwest? That got them, then they got all arrested. Franklin Graham, the great Christian son of Billy Graham, was sent up there to give them the soft side of Jesus. And then they surrendered. There's a new scam on it. It's Breitbart Radio. And the guys running it are mostly Harvard graduates, and they admit they've got a bunch of Jews working for them. And they go on and on about how wonderful Ronald Reagan was and all that kind of stuff. And somebody's putting a lot of money into this, and they're dragging off a lot of these probably pretty good white people into this conservative thing again. And the Breitbart is dead, of course, but they have a recording on him up there that says, "I'm 100% always against racism, and I fought racism all my life, and I'm going to continue fighting racism until I die." And then he died. I'm glad to see the British people getting a little bit of information on this pulling out of the EU. They need to pull out of the EU as fast as possible, and that idiot premier of theirs, or whatever you want to call him, he's a total sellout. At least today the mayor of London came out promoting getting out of the EU. And all those countries over there in the EU should get out. Get out now. Instead of talking about the economy and that and all that kind of stuff, the conservatives like on Breitbart are talking about all the women that Clinton screwed. And they're getting guys on there now with the big books on that. Well, I want to tell you something. That stuff doesn't change in either party. And I'll tell you one thing. If they put an ad in the paper tomorrow, no matter who's president, and say, "Any of you girls want to come around the White House and get screwed," there'd be a line 10 miles long to get in, no matter who's the president. Whenever the Republicans talk about sex and trying to bring up a lot of crap about sex, you know they're covering up something else, because there's just as much sexual corruption in the Republican Party, maybe even more than the Democrat Party.
When the Messiah comes, Rome will be nothing.
Until then, the Nazarene city could rise again after 3 days. Peace and order, if it's true. Will the people believe it? The weak will.
Well, that's from a new movie they got going through the theaters now. Another movie promoting Christianity called The Rising. And I'm telling you, Hollywood works hand in hand many times with Christ's insanity, because they know it does them good. They know it works into their overall plan. And they make a lot of money off these Christ insanity people. You know, they got a lot of good government down there in Texas. Here's an example of one small town in Texas.
We didn't get a proper warning. They didn't post anything. or sent out any type of message to warn the residents. It was pretty scary.
Nora Flores Guerrero said her water just stank last night. Others, though, had pure black water.
It looked like black sludge. You know, they were comparing it to oil, that dark.
What it is sediment from the city's water tower. That's according to the city's water wastewater superintendent. He says the city drained the tower Wednesday night so we could have work done on it. Why didn't they warn people ahead of time? He says they didn't know the murkiness would happen. Crystal City Schools let out early, citing low water pressure. But the district was prepared for the murky water. The superintendent saw it last night and had bottled water brought in.
If I would have known, I probably would have left them home, but I didn't know at all. I just found out this morning.
To fix the issues, the city's been turning on hydrants to flush the water out.
No, the best I can do is you'd have to go buy some water, man.
For now, the city's telling residents to boil what's coming through.
Now, this town is called the Spanish capital of the world, South Texas. And it's almost all Mexican. Black, stinky water unexpectedly flowed from the faucets in a Crystal City on Wednesday. It looked like black sludge. It looked like grease. They were comparing it to oil. That dark, resident Nora Flores said, yeah. But I guess it was only about a week ago that most of the city fathers were arrested by the FBI for corruption. Yeah, that's the future, these growing all Mexican towns, and it's moving north.
FBI, with our state and local partners, were able to liberate Crystal City from the grasp of public corruption.
FBI Special Agent in Charge Chris Combs, joined by United States Attorney Richard Durbin at a news conference, outlining the case against several Crystal City elected officials, accusing them of accepting bribes and kickbacks.
In essence, the indictment alleges that these public officials solicited and accepted bribes in exchange for official action.
FBI agents raiding the town's city hall after arresting Mayor Ricardo Lopez and city council members Rogelio Mata and Roel Mata. In San Antonio, agents arrested local attorney William James Jonas and former Crystal City Councilman Gilbert Urbazo. Jonas is the town's city manager and city attorney, and according to the feds, a key player in the bribery scheme that was discovered by a tip.
Often these cases take years and years. This case was relatively quick for us.
The government alleges the accused accepted bribes, including one totaling more than $12,000 from a contractor in exchange for their votes on a city contract. A businessman from North Texas identified as Noctree Gwen accused of paying the mayor $6,000 for favors.
Even today, during the arrests and the searches that are still ongoing in Crystal City, we had a number of citizens come up to us and not only thank us for what we've done, but provide even further information of the depth of the corruption that was occurring in Crystal City.
Now, in Mexico, this is called, I believe, Mordillo. Mexico's had this bribery thing for 100 years, maybe more. You can't do business without bribing in Mexico. So as the Mexican mestizos move north and populate more and more communities, you're going to see more and more Mordillo, where you got to bribe somebody to get anything done. Welcome to Mexico. I guess they were pretty prophetic when they called the state down there New Mexico. Well, the Hispanic, so-called, and Latino of any race in that Crystal City town is 94.97% of the population. How about this with 90,000 wetbacks going free out of the jails?
Ha ha! Raids and their attorneys are accusing U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement of violating their own rules. The ICE told the families they had no legal recourse to dispute their deportations. Reuters was the first to report on the accusations. They stem from raids U.S. authorities conducted January 2nd through the 4th. During the raids, 121 undocumented immigrants and their children were detained. The families were held at the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas. 33 people and 12 families obtained temporary stays of their deportation orders with the help of CARA Family Detention Pro Bono Project. The organization is a nonprofit that connects immigrants with attorneys.
Internal ICE figures show that in fiscal 2015, the agency encountered 152,393 illegal Mexicans, or Central Americans, or Puerto Ricans, who knows, labeled a criminal threat, mostly in jails, but charged 64,116. About another 88,000 were not processed for deportation, according to the Center for Immigration Studies. The numbers are even worse for those who ICE asked local police and sheriffs to detain but never collect. Wow, let's see about that. Move over there, boy. Let me see here. Okay. Under Obama's recently announced priority enforcement program, officials work with local police to arrest and deport criminal immigrants. They showed pictures of them here, and they're all tatted up with gang tattoos. In reality, that amounts to a phone call from ICE requesting local authorities hold the suspects for 48 hours after they're set to be freed. But several sheriffs from around the country say that just 35-40% of those held are ever seized by ICE, even after they've been released. It's all a big bunch of shit. Richard W. Stanek, sheriff of Hennepin County in Minneapolis, said he had 75 illegal criminals ICE wanted, but the agency only picked up about 35%, and these are people that they want, he told the Washington Examiner. Susan Benton, sheriff of Florida's Highland County, said mine would be much lower. Worse, she added, many are seized and sent to a federal facility in Miami and immediately released and returned to their country, or their county, not their country. It becomes a huge issue for local police, Benton said. What about the citizens who are being robbed, raped, and pillaged by these bastards? Benton said she wants to help ICE and hold illegal immigrants longer, but can't legally. Well, just dump them across the border, you dumbasses. Often the result is more crime from the suspect. Duh. And questions about why her department's jail frees them in the first place. We're the bad guys. We're the ones CNN is on saying that the sheriff left that killer out. Well, he did. David J. Mahoney, sheriff of Dade County in Madison, Wisconsin, said the departments are less likely to comply with ICE requests because of the legal issues and lack of support from the federal government. Then you got tons of these progressive lawyers lobbying to get these people out. It's kind of a do me a favor and hold them for 48 hours or more, when in fact there is no legal standing to do that. ICE says hold them, but we won't defend you if you get sued. The controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal between the U.S. and 11 other countries could spark a new wave of U.S. auto and auto parts makers fleeing to Mexico, a leading Democrat trade expert in the House is warning. Well, Trump has told them he's going to really screw them up if they try that. So just wait. Let's just wait for Trump to do that. Yeah, you'll be waiting a long fucking time. According to Michigan Representative Sandy Levine, the result would be that Americans eventually may be forced to buy TPP cars and trucks assembled in Mexico and largely made of Chinese parts. Levin, the top Democrat on the House and Ways and Means Committee, came out in opposition to the deal last week. She said it includes no demands that Mexico let workers unionize or that it increase automakers' wages above the $8 an hour average. His worry is that many more automakers will flee to cheaper Mexico, one of the countries in the trade pact. Levin said one Detroit company told him that closing a U.S. plant saves them $300 million. Yeah, and where does all that money go to? The big boys at the top of the corporations. He's also upset that Obama trade deal would open the door to Chinese flooding the car parts industry, resulting in cars built in Mexico with mostly cheap Chinese parts that are guaranteed to fail and cause you to wreck. If the deal succeeds, Levine said, every car from Mexico should come with this notice. This model comes with job loss as standard equipment. Well, all you have to do is slap a tariff on them. All you have to do, you want to stop all this shit, is slap tariffs on them. That's what the founding fathers did in this country. The whole budget of the United the colonies was supported by tariffs. That was it. That's all you have to do now, slap tariffs on them. But when's the last time you ever heard a politician say we got to put tariffs on this stuff coming in from these other countries? Not at all, which proves over and over what lousy, corrupt leaders you have. Yeah, those CEOs earn 300 times more than their workers. Isn't that interesting? 300 times. The average CEO, using Bureau of Labor Statistics figures, makes $216,100 a year. On the stump, Clinton's agent, the Harry Walker Agency, Incorporated, charged $275,000 a speech. And package three for Wall Street's Goldman Sachs at $675,000 for Hillary. Yeah. Perry used the BLS average salary for all CEOs, not just the top ones Clinton likes to cite. She also found that the average worker salary is $48,920, about what it was in 2009. That translates into an apples-to-apples wage gap of 44-1. And you wonder why Bernie's getting so many people going to vote for him, that damn old socialist. If that ain't bad enough, the robots are coming. The robots are coming to take over the low-wage workers' jobs. Now, you're importing thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of millions of low-wage workers from all over the Caribbean and Mexico. And now we're replacing what we should have done a long time ago, these jobs with robots. But what's that going to cause? Social welfare programs are going to go through the roof. So white boy, you better get out there and work your ass off, because you got a hell of a lot of brown people to support, plus all the black people. It doesn't bother people like Jeb Bush. He spent $130 million for nothing. Nada. And all those advisors he's got who advise him to do everything wrong. $130 million down the tube. Oh, well, it was fun while it lasted. Well, that's about it for today. 14-5, and especially 5, I have nothing to say. And worse is better. And if you don't listen, you'll have to feel. And if you're still wrapped up in any form of this neocon stuff, get out. If you're still playing hanky-pank with these phony right-wing racial groups, most of them, get out. Because they don't know what the hell's going on, or they're going to do something wrong. They do wrong things all the time. When they're not doing that, they're bad-mouthing people like Terrible Tommy. How about it? And the rest of them are waiting on Jesus to save their ass.
Next recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the Days of Giants by Abby Farwell Brown. The Beginning of Things. The oldest stories of every race of people tell about the beginning of things, but the various folk who first told them were so different. The tales are so very old, and have changed so greatly in the telling from one generation to another, that there are almost as many accounts of the way in which the world began as there are nations upon the earth. So it is not strange that the people of the north have a legend of the beginning quite different from that of the southern, eastern, and western folk. This book is made of the stories told by the northern folk, the people who live in the land of the midnight sun, where summer is green and pleasant, but winter is a terrible time of cold and gloom, where Rocky Mountains tower like huge giants, over whose heads the thunder rolls and crashes, and under whose feet are mines of precious metals. Therefore you will find the tales full of giants and dwarfs, spirits of the cold mountains and dark caverns. You will find the hero to be Thor, with his thunderbolt hammer, who dwells in the happy heaven of Asgard, where All-Father Odin is king, and where Balder the Beautiful makes springtime with his smile. In the North countries, winter, cold, and frost are very real and terrible enemies, while spring, sunshine, and warmth are near and dear friends. So the story of the beginning of things is a story of cold and heat, of the wicked giants who loved the cold, and of the good Æsir who baked in pleasant warmth. In the very beginning of things, the stories say, there were two worlds, one of the burning heat and one of icy cold. The cold world was in the north, and from it flowed Elivagar, a river of poisonous water which hardened into ice and piled up into great mountains, filling the space which had no bottom. The other world in the south was on fire with bright flame, a place of heat most terrible. And in those days, through all space, there was nothing beside these two worlds of heat and cold. But then began a fierce combat. Heat and cold met and strove to destroy each other, as they have tried to do ever since. Flaming sparks from the hot world fell upon the ice river, which flowed from the place of cold. And though the bright sparks were quenched, in dying they wrought mischief, as they do today, for they melted the ice, which dripped and dripped like tears from the suffering world of cold. And then, wonderful to say, these chilly drops became alive, became a huge breathing mass, a frost giant, with a wicked heart of ice. And he was the ancestor of all the giants who came afterwards, a bad and cruel race. At that time there was no earth, nor sea, nor heaven, nothing but the icy abyss without bottom, whence Ymir the giant had sprung. And there he lived, nourished by the milk of a cow which the heat had formed. Now the cow had nothing for her food but the snow and ice of Elivagar, and that was cold victuals indeed. One day she was licking the icy rocks, which tasted salty to her, when Ymir noticed that the mass was taking a strange shape. The more the cow licked it, the plainer became the outline of the shape. And when evening came, Ymir saw, thrusting itself through the icy rock, a head of hair. The next day the cow went on with her meal, and at night time a man's head appeared above the rock. On the third day the cow licked away the ice, until forth stepped a man, tall and powerful and handsome. This was no evil giant, for he was good. And strangely, though he came from the ice, his heart was warm. He was the ancestor of the kind Æsir, for All-Father Odin and his brothers, Vili and Ve, the first of the gods, were his grandsons, and as soon as they were born they became the enemies of the race of the giants. Now, after a few giant years, ages and ages of time as we reckon it, there was a great battle, for Odin and his brothers wished to destroy all the evil in the world and to leave only good. They attacked the wicked giant Ymir. First of all his race, and after hard fighting, slew him. Ymir was so huge that when he died, a mighty river of blood flowed from the wounds which Odin had given him.